And thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and as always, I'm wishing you the best. And we love to hear from you. You can join us at naturalnurse.com anytime you want, because that, of course, was where we post our shows, our radio shows, and we have many, many lectures and courses going on. If you'd like to find out the names and how to register, just go to naturalnurse.com and visit calendar. That's a good place to look at up and coming classes. For instance, right now, we have one called Feeling the Consciousness of Plants, where we do interspecies communication networking between ourselves and our wonderful plant allies. And we have a class coming up called Using Herbs for Yourself and Your Family. When these classes have passed date, we also have them available as an archive rather than joining in live. And then we have a series of classes coming up on Hildegard. Hildegard of Bingen. She is a mystic, psychic, visionary, and master herbalist. Of course, in her day, we didn't use the word herbalist because everybody, that's what they did. And she was alive in the year 1098 to 1179. So she was an amazing ancient mystic. She is now a saint. She did not get sainted until recently in the 2000s, but we'll be talking about the fact that she was an ancient herbalist, and she was also the founder of scientific natural history in Germany. And she worked with a combination of mystical visions, psychic impressions, and observations of nature. And she developed an amazing array of natural therapies that sounds like what we call natural medicine today, using specific foods. For instance, she recommended spelt rather than wheat. She did gemstone therapy, where she actually inserted specific gems, let's say in your nostrils for congestion or on your heart for heart disease. And those gemstones are still used today in gem therapy. She also was a master herbalist and developed complex formulations, which were written down. So we have them to look at today. And one of the things that I love, which she developed her investigation based on various diagnostic techniques that she chose, along with physical treatments and holistic methods based on sound healing and spiritual healing and herbal tinctures and stones, and recognizing the four elements such as fire, air, water, and earth. So it sounds so much like, you know, what I would call modern holistic medicine, yet she was doing it thousands of years ago. And when we investigate her protocols and then look at the scientific evidence that has been since done to support those therapeutics, we find out what a master she is, or perhaps was, because they're still work today, but she developed them without any scientific process other than her own observational skills and psychic intuition. So a real master to study. We're having several classes on her. We also have a free meetup for Hildegard once a month through the American Herbalist Guild. Over 400 people actually signed up for that last month, and you're certainly welcome to join us. And we have one also coming up on the healthy happy brain, how to use foods and herbs to sustain cognition and memory, and lots of on-ground walks and herb workshops in the Long Island area. So if you just go to naturalnurse.com calendar, you can certainly join in. Or perhaps you would like to discuss how can you move your career into something that is natural. And we have a whole class on that called Careers in Natural Health. So get in touch and we will share that information with you. We would love to bring on board our guest today, and his name is Mark Williams, and he is an ethnobiologist. His website is botanyeveryday.com. That's a great place to find him, and you will we'll be giving that out during the show. Now, ethnobiologist Mark Williams has taught hundreds of classes to many thousands of people around the world about plants, humans and other life forms and how they interface. His conventional training includes a bachelor's in environmental studies and sustainable agriculture, and also looking at business, specifically in Appalachian studies and sustainable development from Appalachian State University, and also studied geography. He spent over 20 years working in various places such as restaurants, farms, and traveling throughout over 30 countries and all 50 states in the USA, teaching and bringing together all the in-depth understanding and knowledge that he has. So thank you so much for joining us today, Mark.
Thank you, Ellen. I'm glad to join you again.
Now, this show is on Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be together till, you know, just about an hour all the way till 11, so you can feel free and not rush to delve into anything you would like. And I think you have a very interesting history about how you wound up, you know, right now focusing on Appalachia, but obviously that road has been long and diverse. So how did you start out as a child finding that you had some interest and connection to plants, if that's when it started?
Awesome question. Thank you. And yes, I would say it was really more in a subtle way when I was a child, because I am in this lineage of a military family, and definitely my dad's biggest goal for me was to be an officer in the military all the way up until I went to college with a four-year ROTC scholarship. And so I can look back and see where I had interest in plants with various different science projects, or just the solace and the peace that they gave me. And growing up in South Florida, which is kind of like the tropics, it's much different than most of the US, but it was really more after I left that ROTC program in Orlando, Florida, and moved to Gainesville, Florida, and kind of met up with a whole different community of people that I didn't know even existed as a child, that I really started to get into nature by going to, you know, various potlucks and going and hanging out at the Plaza de Americas at the University of Florida, and really just kind of getting immersed in the culture that's part of Gainesville.
Well, I really love Gainesville. What a special place that is. And I spent several years there as well. And it has a very unique botanical signature, nothing like South Florida. It has that beautiful place called the Plains. Mm-hmm. There were actually wild horses still running around, and a vast array of amazing plants and animals.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an overlap between where I am now in Appalachia, and in the tropics, because you have, you know, people growing bananas, for instance, all the way up there in Gainesville, but then you also have the oaks and the maples and the elderberries that a lot of people might be familiar with from further north, and they kind of mix in this really beautiful way.
Well, I want to just send a shout out to my business partner and co-author, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, is a naturopathic physician and also teaches botany and botanical pharmacology, and he's a plant lover. Just to say, he grows bananas in Connecticut.
Wow.
And in the mountains in Connecticut, which is like the coldest area. He has YouTubes about it. He bought a specialized, something that was sort of more winterized kind of banana plant, and then grows it against his house, covers it in the winter. He actually gets bananas on that thing every year. It's really amazing.
That is amazing. I never would have guessed that could be possible that far north.
I know, but he loves the tropics, so he brought the tropics to him. But it just reminded me of that when you were talking about the fact that even in Gainesville, which is north for Florida, although not north for the United States, but you don't get that tropical feel there. You get that open plains kind of feel. There's lots of deciduous trees. It does get cool in the winter.
Yeah, and then, of course, the lovely springs everywhere, too.
Yeah, that was a special place. And also, I don't know if you ever hiked the sinkhole.
Oh, yeah. Devil's Mill Hopper.
Yes.
One of the more famous ones. Yeah. And that at the bottom of that is really like being in Appalachia, which is so interesting because of the microclimate that's, you know, created down there at the bottom. It's much cooler than you would have at the surface.
Right. So that's why I found Gainesville really interesting. And because of the college that I actually worked for a holistic doctor there. He has since passed away. His name was Dr. Hanak Talmor. And Dr. Talmor was very involved with the holistic community in Gainesville. So we did have a lot of potluck dinners and lots of networking. And it's really a wonderful place to live if anyone's thinking of a nice place to live.
Amen.
And then, of course, it has the college there also. So, you know, that kind of college culture. So that's interesting that you found yourself there. And how did you get involved then in environmental studies?
Yeah, it was really a very incremental process. First, really looking at food choices while I was still living in Gainesville in the late 90s and kind of understanding the inherent unsustainability of a lot of large-scale food production and getting into food production myself and finding out about concepts like permaculture. And really, I guess, like a meeting with a friend who happened to have family in Asheville, where I live now and have lived since 1999. That was what facilitated coming up here. I was visiting his family with him, I think in 97 or 98, and just fell in love with the mountains and Asheville as a specific location. And of course, people in Asheville, North Carolina are becoming more and more famous for their environmental awareness. And once I really immersed myself in the culture here, it just kind of naturally unfolded, first working on an organic farm and in a cafe that that farm supplied produce to, and then figuring out, okay, this is something maybe I want to do with my life. And had always thought about going to college, but after leaving, you know, post this whole military training thing, I was a bit at a loss and grasping at straws, but it really locked in once I really fell in love with the natural world and growing my own food and trying to understand all the different organisms that were around me. And so that led me to go to college at Warren Wilson, which is just outside of Asheville, and really dive deeply into environmental studies and all the things connected with that.
And I would say, even though you got that degree quite a while ago, right now with all the sudden talk of climate change, I minored in environmental studies at Cornell University in the 1960s, believe it or not. And even at that time, all the textbooks had all the predictions, like Dr. Ehrlich and Ehrlich, who were husband and wife team, very famous in environmental studies, and they were professors there. Every single thing that is going on now was well known that it would be going on. So how is it that we allowed it to happen anyway?
That is just so true. And that's a question I ask myself all the time, because like you said, when I was in school almost a couple decades ago, so, you know, we had had these warnings since the 60s and Rachel Carson and Silent Spring and all those things. And then it still was when I was in school, even more solid, but yet still kind of ignored. And unfortunately, even up to this day, I mean, there's certainly more awareness around climate change.
Well, there's little chatter. There's little chatter right now.
Yeah, I think there's more awareness, but definitely not enough action.
No, almost nothing, really. Yeah. And it's really horrible, because if we think about the fact, you know, without getting into politics, that the whole viewpoint can change instantly, like in a year, to where they disregard all environmental considerations. I really wonder where all that is going to go. But it seems like someone like yourself, if you were willing, besides that you do a lot of work with others who are interested in this, with your work through Botany Every Day and all your training and teaching, I wonder if you would be willing to sort of jump back into some mainstream stuff, even locally on a political level, to actually, with your knowledge, help facilitate some real change.
Well, that's a really interesting question, in that, you know, we all basically have our voice in the choir. And I have definitely determined in my life for quite a while now that I really need to, just for my own personal health and sanity, focus on promoting what I want versus what I don't want to a certain degree, you know, which oftentimes once you come up into, you know, mainstream society, whether that's business or politics and government or whatever, you're going to find a lot of pushback and oftentimes need to be more in an activist, if not even antagonistic role. And yeah, we all have to kind of find where we're best suited. But I mean, having done some things like that, like for instance, I was on the Tree Commission of Asheville for 3 years, donating my time, you know, every month for our meeting and lots of hours in between. And to be honest, it was pretty humbling, like this, you know, even with goodwill and interest from the community, how slow the bureaucratic wheels turn and how often it's one step forward and two steps back. And after 3 years in that position, I left, I must say, a bit kind of disappointed in how slow that progress can be. And another principle of permaculture, which I mentioned earlier, is this idea of planning to harvest a yield. So basically not waste your energy. And I wouldn't say my energy was necessarily a total waste, but the efficiency of getting things done through that process versus direct action in my garden or kind of with people that are already super excited and willing and ready to grab the bull by the horns and run with it, that I feel like is at least currently more where I am aligned towards.
I understand that, but it's good that you gave it a try.
And I will again, you know, but it's like we all have to kind of take that as it comes and know when to say when.
It's true. It's hard because I am an activist on both levels. Like even let's say in my little community that I live in Florida, which is called Century Village. It's a retirement community, you know, very straight laced in a lot of ways, but I interjected myself into some of the committees, the governing committees there, and they've actually moved. For instance, they took an old golf course and then you have to get a different variance to use it for a different thing. And so now it is actually going to be like a park area. They're going to call it Central Park. So they're considering an architectural design company to bring in. And just through me being there and others, they were able to decide on an architectural design firm. The head of that person is part of the Florida Native Plant Society. So a little thing like that can really change the whole thing from having natural wild plants on those trails versus grass that needs pesticides and water.
That is so true. And that's a really great example of like hitting it right in that sweet spot of engaging when the interest is there and having the connections to kind of bridge those worlds together. And I feel like, of course, yeah, the interest is also growing more as time goes on and we realize the situation our species is in.
It is, and it's dire. And someone with your degree of knowledge, compassion, training, you know, you're in a really good position right now to both, you know, support yourself and help others. So I think that's excellent and really a model for, let's say, upcoming herbalists. What would you say to upcoming herbalists in terms of, you know, something that they could do to prepare themselves both for their own future and to be useful in the world in their future?
Wow. That's a big one. I think of when I teach for Seven Song, who's another famous herbalist in our country out of Ithaca, New York, the Northeast School of Botanical Studies. And he asked me to answer that question for his students. And so I guess one thing is to really get some good training with some good people and maybe also not stop at one person, but really kind of, in sounds like how you've done too, you know, study with a number of different people so you can really get a holistic perspective around healing and to whatever degree possible to do that in person as things open back up versus, you know, I think there's a place for online learning, for an initial foray, or for certainly your own personal edification and what you might do in your own life. But if you really want to be like a practicing, like a clinical herbalist, then there's a lot of due diligence that goes into making sure that you have the adequate training. And luckily we have so many incredible schools. The American Herbalist Guild is a great organization that has a list of herbal schools around the country. But of course, then there's awesome, amazing books out there. And I know books are a little anachronistic these days, but I'm holding tight.
Wait a minute. New word watch. I keep listening to new words for me. What does that mean? Anachronistic? Yeah, I love that.
If you think of chronology, that's like a time, right? So Anna is like, it's like old school, I guess would be a way to say that. It's something that's not as common in the current realm, you know, with Marie Kondo telling everybody to throw away their books, which feel free to send them to me.
Don't say that, Mark. I'm moving. I have so many art books. I'd love to have a new home for them with there. And I mean some really classical art books.
I'm
too.
So glad I said it then. Uh-huh. I am wholeheartedly serious. I think for as long as I'm living, I've got breath in my body and the ability, I will always give home to books that are needing one.
Well, that's a wonderful recommendation. I'm putting that on my list too, along with anachronistic, because I really do learn new things every single day.
There's always more to learn, right?
No, none of us know everything. And those are great suggestions for people who do go, wow, what is an ethnobiologist? Is there a real study of ethnobiologists? That's what you are. What does that mean? Oh,
right. Yes, that's who I am. And it's probably worth just unpacking that really quickly, because it's, even though it is a term that's been around for decades, and there's an academic journal, the Journal of Ethnobiology, dedicated to it that goes back decades, it's a little bit more obscure. So ethnology, even as a science, is a little bit more obscure. But people, if they think of the root of like an ethnic group, for instance, like ethnology is the study of cultures, different groups. And then biology is, of course, the study of life. And so if you combine the study of cultures and life, then you get what is the interface? How do people depend on other life forms, basically, for food, for medicine, for spiritual practices, for the material culture of their built environment and their textiles and that sort of thing?
That is really interesting, because yesterday I did give a presentation on interspecies communication with plants. And one of the scientific, not very new, but something that they did find out, which I find fascinating in that realm, when you're talking about interacting with other species, is the fact that on our cells, we have actual different receptor sites in a signaling mechanism, and there are different receptor sites for interspecies communication and intraspecies communication. So these are not things that we're just sort of feeling when we're talking to plants, and I know you must talk to plants. There are actually differential receptor sites, because that is a different species. Many people may have experienced that with their, let's say, dog or cat, or other companion animal, where you really get a message from them. But the point is, you actually do. And it's through a specific receptor mechanism that is unique. So there's always a deeper understanding of each and everything.
Wow, that's fascinating to hear. I'm not familiar with that knowledge. So it makes me want to kind of dig in after we get off the call here about that science, because I think a lot of people intuitively feel that especially with their pets.
Well, that actual research was done on bacteria, and the fact that they can get together with other species of bacteria to construct something called biofilms, which is like plaque on your teeth, but it's also in your arteries. Okay. So how do they change form, work together like in an ant colony? To, you know what, you make the structure and I'll make the base, and you send out, like they work together to build basically a city. And that's where these receptor sites were discovered, but they feel that it's actually a universal auto-inducer and actually is in others, that how other species communicate with each other. So I'll send you that too. It's like just endless learning. But you've been able to put together your interests and create what you do in life and also help so many people along the way. I know you have some excellent courses on botany every day, and you have YouTube videos, and I guess you also have live classes going on also.
That's true. It's really kind of a patchwork quilt, which folds into your earlier question about, you know, kind of advice to budding herbalists or educators, because it's not really set it and forget it turnkey kind of path. You know, you really do have to sort of carve out your spaces. And for me, being really into kind of the super geeky academic realm, that is a space that I always would like to inhabit. And at the same time, working more with the general lay public is something that really intrigues me too. And certainly the idea that we all need a certain basic level of nature knowledge that we're kind of missing in our general education now is part of my offering of the Botany Every Day online class by donation. Because such important knowledge feels like it shouldn't be limited by monetary ability. But at the same time, you know, I teach for really high-end conferences and colleges and universities and arboretums and botanical gardens and everything in between, both in person and online, although, of course, more online in this last year.
Right, like us all. Well, we do have to take a little break right here, Mark. And when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion. We're talking today with Mark Williams, ethnobiologist, and check out his website, botanyeveryday.com. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the folklore, history, chemistry, and medicinal applications of the common kitchen herb, thyme.
The common culinary spice known botanically as Thymus vulgaris is only one member of a large genera which includes over 400 species and even more varieties. The Thymus genera is originally native to the Mediterranean region and is a perennial plant which grows wild in usually dry, sandy soil, green heaths, and grasslands. Thyme is a prolific, fragrant, creeping ground cover and often displays an attractive spray of flowering branchlets spanning the spectrum from white to violet.
There is considerable debate amongst historians as to the origin of the name thyme. Some believe it to be from the Greek thymen, meaning to fumigate or to burn a sack.
Hey, Ellen?
What happened?
No, it's still playing. I just... Okay. Mark, can you speak a little closer to the mic? You're coming in a little low.
Okay, I will definitely do that. I do have the external mic in.
Lean into it,
or maybe even test it real quick, taking it out, because you're coming in so low. No, still low.
So just leaning in might be good, right? That'll move. If you plug it in and lean
in. I'm right over it now.
How's that?
Better. You want to try it quickly taking it out? Is it just a USB mic?
Yeah. It's one of those blue snowball.
Yeah, blue snowball one? Yeah. Do snowballs have like a volume control on them?
It might have a one, two, and three switch that changes his tones. So he could be on like tone one. If he hits the switch to two, it might make him louder.
You want to just unplug it quick, Mark, see what happens?
Okay, it is unplugged now.
Much louder.
Maybe that's the thing, then, to not use it.
Yeah. Yeah, Zoom has a great great audio feature to it.
Okay.
Awesome.
On your hands, try making a thyme tea made with just a few teaspoons of thyme to a cup of boiling water. It's an excellent diaphoretic because it causes the body to perspire profusely. Thyme also possesses an excellent carminative and antispasmodic effect, helping in poor digestion, flatulence, and intestinal gripe.
So, listeners, if you're feeling ill, thyme heals all wounds. Remember to reach for that thyme in a bottle the next time you open up the natural medicine chest.
And we're back with more right here on The Natural Nurse. And Dr. Z, thank you so much for joining us today. And we're here with ethnobiologist, Mr. Mark Williams. That's Mark with a C. And his website to find out more is botanyeveryday.com. And if you were to go there, you see that he has a lot of excellent courses. And we were just mentioning a course that he's running online. And, you know, there's various days that it looks like it's live, but it's probably also available sort of ongoingly in an archived version. And if you were going to be studying just for your own knowledge, or even as a registered herbalist through the American Herbalist Guild, and I mentor students through that process, you could actually use Mark's course as a botany class. So it's really wonderful that you offer that to the public. What are some of the things that would be good to know, you know, if you did even want to take an herb walk in the woods? Why would it be really important to know a little bit about botany, Mark?
Well, there's so many reasons that it would be important. Yes, first and foremost, especially if you're looking to actually harvest, that you want to do that in a safe way and not hurt yourself unintentionally. And I think a lot of people are real intimidated by that sort of just idea, right? They might think it's almost like from the fairy tales and wizards and the elves and that type of thing, like I did growing up, that isn't even real. And they kind of see the plant world as what we call the green wall. And it's just this one monolithic entity of quote unquote plants. And yet, once you know botany, it starts to resolve into this amazing pattern of textures and colors and sizes and shapes and forms, and also, of course, chemistry and potential applications. And it's really not that hard to get very, very far along the lines of what is out there that's especially readily abundant and maybe even in need of being curtailed some in regards to some of these more invasive plants, that you learn kind of plants by family groupings. I would say that's one of the biggest, most powerful aspects of learning botany, is instead of learning plants as individuals, you learn them in these greater groups that they're part of, that oftentimes can tell you whether they're edible, medicinal, poisonous, or helpful for various other things. And these family groupings, a lot of people would be familiar with, like the rose family or the mustard family or the mint family or the mallow family. And those are indeed some of the first families to learn in regards to lots of common and available food and medicine.
So that's wonderful, because right on your website at botanyeveryday.com, you have a link for plant families, and apparently you actually list the plant families, and if you click on those, there's all kinds of information about them right there, and in a really clear format.
Yeah, that's true, especially those main families I was just talking about, because as I was saying earlier, I just really want to empower people to reclaim this knowledge that is the heritage of all of us. Somewhere back in our lineage, we have people that depended on these things and knew them well without even one scrap of a day at some college class, I might mention too, but just through the lineage of learning from their elders and applying that knowledge in the present for themselves.
And like you said, Mark, many people have multicultural backgrounds, as you yourself do, and many people do. No matter where someone is from, they're one or two generations back, there was someone who knew herbs, because pharmaceutical drugs are like really brand new on the scene.
That's true. It's true. And so reclaiming that, and especially in the kind of idea of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and that lifestyle choices that are more mild can help to avoid issues that are much more acute and chronic later. That's where I think a lot of this idea of the food as medicine and employing some of these wild plants and fungi can be really helpful.
Well, let's go. I'm looking at your plant family, and I would say a good one for us to talk about in a little depth right now, if you can share, that there are certain plant families where a lot of their members are poisonous. And that might be a good one to study first before you think you're going to go out and do some foraging.
Well, that's very true. Yeah. And certain families are kind of almost always poisonous with some exceptions that are edible. And then some families are almost always edible with some exceptions that are poisonous. So it's really important to know those exceptions as well as the general trends. But like the buttercup family would be an example that is, you know, mostly poison to maybe low dose medicinals and not really hardly any food. And the nightshade family would be another one that has a lot of poisons. It's a huge family, but then it's in the middle in that it also has a lot of food, like tomatoes and potatoes and peppers. But even some people in certain traditions consider some of those very common vegetables I just mentioned as potentially irritating.
And they are to me. And I'll tell you why they are to me. It's kind of interesting because through wildcrafting and experimentation, there's a plant called a sacred datura plant that you're probably mm-hmm. familiar with, and they have a thorn apple on them. Mm-hmm. And I decided to eat one of those. And 3 or 4 days later, found myself wandering in the desert. This is a long time ago. So, but ever since that, and my partner, Dr. Eugene, the naturopath, mentioned that maybe I overstimulated those receptor sites, because ever since then, if I eat any tomatoes or green peppers or eggplant, which are all in that family, I get a similar reaction, not all the way, but where I get, let's say, blurred vision for about 6 hours.
Wow.
So I just have to stay away from, you know, the Solanaceae plants. And like you said, there were many people are allergic to that. In fact, even in the Middle Ages, they were considered to be poisonous, which is interesting, rather than a food crop.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that a lot of the food crops from that family that are at least, you know, very popular across the world are from the Americas, whereas in Europe, for instance, most of the things in that family are either poisonous and maybe even deadly or very much medicinal in small quantities. And so they didn't really have too much of a reference when the explorers started bringing things back from the Americas as food. And they grew tomatoes ornamentally, for instance, for a while. And it's hard to imagine Italian food without tomatoes. And some people might not realize that tomatoes are from the Americas, but or potatoes are from Peru versus Ireland.
That's really interesting. I never knew that either. So you're saying that tomatoes were not a natural crop in Italy until they were brought back from the New World?
Correct.
So what did they use for tomato sauce?
I tell you what, right? It must have been a whole different cuisine. I've never seen a book on that, but that would be a fascinating book.
Italian food before tomatoes. Wow. I never heard of that or would have thought of that. So actually, it was found in the New World. That's where they found sort of the ancient varieties of tomato. And then it was brought back to Italy, where it was developed into one of the main food sources.
Exactly.
That's interesting. But, you know, also, because in my book that I wrote on arthritis, we talk a lot about the fact that nightshades have been studied because they do have an inflammatory response in about 30% of individuals. So most people with long-term arthritis and other rheumatoid and autoimmune problems, I always suggest that they stop all nightshades for 30 days. Because even though it's 30% of people that will have a marked decrease in inflammation, what's the side effect of trying?
You know, that is such a great point that you make, Ellen, and that oftentimes when we're challenged, we're looking for what can we add, you know, especially what's the silver bullet, the one thing that will take it all away and make it better. And yet we don't think about, well, what can we like extract, right? And an elimination diet, whether like you're saying, such low stakes to just take that out and see if you feel better, but that could also happen with gluten, for instance, and a number of other things that are known to irritate people, dairy, soy. I think of so many things that you could try just getting your diet super basic and then reintroducing some of these potential inflammatory types of foods and see how you feel. And it can be very stark, like you said, if you take a month off
right.
and then bring it back.
So back to the culturalness of Italians eating tomatoes. When I have mentioned to try to do this to people of Italian heritage, they absolutely freak out. And it's very challenging because it has to do at this point with mom and, you know, grandmom and love and, you know, a lot of things to try to stop those tomatoes. But when they try it, very often it is a major trigger of pain. So it was so worth it. It's really interesting. So right on your website, where I am at botanyeveryday.com, you can go there yourself, click on plant families. And then I just went to the tomato family. And Mark, this is fantastic information that you're just sharing for free about different foods that you might. And there are things in the woods here in the Northeast, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which are nightshade plants also that really are not good as edibles.
Yeah, that's true. There's even controversy. Of course, so much of life happens online now, and just like any kind of interest, there's groups that focus on these types of things, whether it's foraging or general botany. And whenever any of the wild nightshades come up as a potential food or even medicine, it's always or often going to be something that's kind of controversial, because there's, you know, so many foods that are out there, hundreds of different kinds. And once you get into a group like that, the margin for error is so much less than if you're in a group like the mint family or the mustard family or some of the other more mellow ones.
Which we'll talk about next. But you do such a great job in this one sheet, you know, that could take years to get all this information together. It's excellent and it's free. And I really suggest people take a look at it before they start going out and gathering plants to eat, because you do have many members are deadly, and you actually have a list of a lot of them that are pretty common, you know, so, and tomato is one of them, but that's the Solanum lycopersicum. Is that a regular tomato or is that a special tomato?
That's the main tomato, which they changed the name. Unfortunately, it was Lycopersicum esculentum, but now they've put it in the same genus as things like potatoes, which is another Solanum, Solanum tuberosum. So that's the common one, although there are some other species. And actually in our garden where I live in Asheville, North Carolina, it's very hard to grow tomatoes, but there's another species of a very small kind of tomato, often in the trade called Matt's Wild Cherry, that comes up of its own accord by itself. It's kind of weedy even, but it's super delicious and it's disease resistant. And so I was just talking with someone I live with yesterday about how we're probably giving up trying to grow those big brandy wines because they just aren't happy.
Yeah, just go buy them in the farmer's market, right?
That was exactly, we do have friends that have a hoop house and really the perfect conditions. And they said, we'll leave that one to the experts.
And that's a wise decision. So yeah, being regional is certainly one of the things. Now, I have another friend, and he's a botanist and also a horticulturist. And he went to a junior college, got a 2-year degree in horticulture, and he became a horticulturist and greenhouse manager for a 400-acre beautiful estate here on Long Island, which is also a national park. And he has worked there for 52 years.
Wow.
So just to say, and lived on the 400 acres in a little cottage, right? So,
wow.
You know, these things can, your interests can lead to, you know, some substantial employment opportunities where you're not giving up what you love to do. And so, you know, you have just so many beautiful educational opportunities. Now, we talked about one plant family, which be aware of so that you don't pick those unless you're sure of what it is. Let's talk about one of the families, such as the mustard family, which is so prolific throughout the United States as ground cover and in fields, and is not too much that might be poisonous.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of on the other end of the spectrum in that there's really one plant that I'm familiar with out of well over 100 different species that could potentially be poisonous out of that family, which is called woad. It's actually a very famous plant from Europe, but it's kind of invasive in some parts of the U.S. But in general, and that would be kind of like low dose, of course, there's a realm of like something that might give you a bit of a tummy ache, not low dose, I don't think I meant to say, but something that's not very toxic, you know, versus like on the other extreme, some of the things in the nightshade family that could just straight up kill you. But there's guaranteed, short of the long of it, anywhere you're at in the world where it is gets cold, where it freezes, you are guaranteed to be surrounded by edible members of the mustard family. And there are lots of cultivated ones as well as things in the wild, but people would be familiar beyond mustard with kale and collard greens and broccoli and cauliflower and kohlrabi and radishes and arugula, and could just go on with the amazingness, both as a green and then also some root crops like turnips as well and rutabagas that are cherished all over the world, anywhere that it gets cold.
So thank you so much for that. We are going to take another little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z so that you can hear listeners from Progressive Radio Network, where you get progressive radio voices all the time. I believe we're the largest progressive radio network that broadcasts all over the world. And thank you so much for joining us today. And when we come back, we will continue our fascinating discussion with ethnobiologist Mark Williams and visit his site, botanyeveryday.com. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse. Please visit naturalnurse.com. You can email us through there. You can Facebook us from there at Natural Nurse Facebook. And you can also look at calendar. That's the best place to look at many of our upcoming classes. You might want to find out how you could become a professional herbalist, a registered herbalist, or perhaps you'd like to integrate some natural healing into your own life and lifestyle. Our guest today is Mark Williams, and he has a wonderful website called botanyeveryday.com. And Mark, welcome back to our show.
Thank you so much, Ellen. And I would love to just follow up a little bit with what we were talking about before the break.
Please do.
About that mustard family. And that there definitely is some talk, and I think even some research about people with thyroid issues and the mustard family potentially being something like you could try that elimination diet that we were talking about before. And I just recently learned that the lady I live with, she just had a baby a month ago. And apparently that nursing mothers might think about not consuming things from the mustard family because they can be a little bit irritating to the baby.
Yeah, there's a lot of complexity. So therefore, you're saying learn about plants, consider wildcrafting, but you know, sometimes it gets very trendy in terms of foraging and people really do get themselves in trouble because they have not studied with someone like yourself to decide which plants they're gathering. They just think, oh, those look nice or something. And that's not the way to go.
Yeah, or you learn enough to be dangerous, you know, as they say, you don't know what you don't know. And I think that there's a scientific term for the Dunning-Kruger effect, where you have an overconfidence because you've learned a little bit and you think that's a lot.
Yeah, we see that all the time, certainly. And I'd like to give you a chance, we're getting towards the end of our show, but we've had so many interesting things. I do want you to share about someone who's been very important to you and your learning and your life, which is Frank Cook. And I know you've dedicated a lot of work to bring his work forward into the future.
That's so true. And I appreciate you calling Frank in, because he's certainly, I would say, my largest influence as a botanist and as an educator. And I've had a lot of influences and a lot of amazing teachers. But Frank passed away in 2009 in August. And in particular, in his passing, I was very moved to continue certain threads of his work without a doubt. And then that kind of has accumulated over time in the last decade or so. But the online class that we've been talking about is something that I inherited from Frank. He did for 9 years, and now I'm on my 12th year of doing it after his passing. And yeah, just so many things in regards to the education of the public about where we need to head to be more sustainable, because Frank traveled all over the world, learned from various different healers and indigenous groups and academicians, and brought that knowledge to bear in the form of various different publications and lots of essays and videos, and of course teaching lots of classes in person, and even led international trips to places like Africa and India and various parts of Latin America. And so those are some of the threads that I have also continued on to certain degrees, like leading international tours being one. But that's also something that I'm kind of moving away from in the moment, as you know, the world, like we were talking about, is just such a different place than it was a decade ago.
Yeah, travel is not the same, because we had a yearly, in fact, I actually have a website called Echo Tours for Cures. And for over 40 years, we have been taking people to all kinds of undeveloped areas of the world, basically studying plant medicine and ethnocultural kinds of things. And it really, this is the first year we didn't do it in 40 years.
Wow.
And even next year, we're not so on board, because when you go through a lot of these airports now, you have to have vaccination records, and it's just getting very complex.
It's true. And is that related to the Echo that's in Fort Myers, or that's something totally unrelated?
Yeah, that's ours is called, our website is actually called Echo Tours for Cures.
Oh, Echo, like ECO.
Yes. Oh, yeah. ECO, EchoToursForCures.com. And people can still go look at that. You know, we had lots of places focused a lot on the north coast of Jamaica with the Maroon culture. That was a really heavy focus of ours for many, many, many decades, including studying with various elders there, such as Jamba of the Maroons, who contributed heavily to several of the books that I wrote. And of course, he wanted us. That's the interesting thing with what you're doing also, even with Frank and others, because it wasn't about taking his work. He asked us to, because he didn't write, and he had 17 of his own children, and not one of them was the least bit interested in bush medicine of Jamaica.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating subject, and certainly one of the most famous areas for it, this idea of the cultural legacy of elders and how we can bring that forward to the future, and of course do it in an equitable and ethical frame. And there's actually going to be a big conference in Jamaica. Maybe we'll see you there next year for the Society for Economic Botany. And some of my favorite colleagues work in that area. And I really do look forward to comparing some notes with you sometimes, because the traditions we might think of kind of like in a monolithic way once again, but really healer to healer, grandma to grandma, grandpa to grandpa, you know, valley to valley, mountain chain to mountain chain, even at a small island like Jamaica, you can find quite a bit of diversity as far as bush medicine and the roots tonics that they might make.
Yes, and that's somewhere where the concept of genus and species from a Western perspective really can be helpful, because they may call something, you know, a ram goat dash along, let's say, which is a sexual stimulant because the ram goats eat it and go after the females, but it might be different plants that got that name in different little micro climate areas, where if we know the genus and species name, we know we're talking about the same plant.
Yeah, it's really more of a taxonomy, like a classification more by use. And so you might call things the same thing because they do the same thing in the body versus because they're closely related botanically. And you have these terms like duppy, for instance, that you hear duppy this and duppy that.
Duppy
and,
soursop.
Yep, exactly. And yeah, the ram goat people might be interested and familiar with it by another name, which is Damiana. Mm-hmm. At least Damiana is related to that. And those are the kind of things that are really neat too, because Damiana, of course, is famous as an aphrodisiac super far away from there. And when you see those overlaps among different cultures and different places, that's always really intriguing.
So it's all fascinating. And I'm so happy that we got a chance to chat, and we will talk again soon. And I will send you a link to this show, which you can use any way you'd like once we have it posted. And do you have any parting comments for our audience?
Sure. Yeah, I would say, if people want to follow up with me, we've mentioned the botanyeveryday.com site, and there's a sister site that preserves and archives and continues the legacy of Frank Cook at plantsandhealers.org. There's a bunch of recipes up there, and as I mentioned, essays and videos, and even some of his writings in book form, like his master's thesis from Schumacher College, that people can download as well.
Well, thank you so much for all the work you do as an ethnobotanist and person of the earth, helping to move forward, you know, sustainable living, which if we don't do, we won't have a place to live. But I don't know what the challenge is there. But nonetheless, you're moving forward with your knowledge, helping on what I consider the right side.
Well, it certainly takes a village, and I really appreciate being part of a village with you.
And thank you so much, listeners, for joining us once again for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. On behalf of myself and my co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, we hope that you stay healthy.